the faith with the latest from Rome, the front lines of the pro-life movement, and we'll also take a look at other crucial issues facing you and your family in our one holy Catholic and apostolic church.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I'm back with Dr. Joseph Bottom to talk some more. He, as you may know, was formerly editor of First Things, literary editor of the Weekly Standard, and author of many books, the most recent being An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America. Jody Bottom, who's been a friend for many years, has been described in National Review as the poetic voice of modern Catholic intellectual life. His work shaped the minds of a generation. I think that's true, although some may not understand just what a poetic voice is. And in this hour, we're actually going to talk about things like poetry and the novel and literature, really our first love, if I speak for Jody, in terms of what we personally are drawn to when it comes to giving our minds and our writing over to things. And, of course, Jody Bottom's also a writer of fiction. I should have mentioned that, but I'm going to mention it now, in that each Christmas he publishes some specific kind of Christmas memory, which has become very popular, and he has written a childhood memoir. These have been collected in a book entitled The Christmas Plains, which was published in 2012. So in talking to Jody, we're talking about someone not only who reads well and is a critic, but someone who's a writer. Jody, has becoming a writer of fiction, which you've done, I think, in the last 10 years or 12 years, has that made you a better critic, a better reader?
Curiously, Deal, I think that writing fiction has made me a worse critic, at least of novels. When I read novels now, I find myself too fascinated by, too concentrating on the sheer technique of the writer,
yeah,
which is not actually a recipe for good criticism.
It's robbed you of your first naivete.
Exactly.
So now you're sort of in between trying to recapture the naivete, what Ricoeur called the second naivete?
Well, that would be lovely if I could achieve it, but since few of us do until we've emerged from purgatory, what I've really discovered is that I can only read unselfconsciously now in fiction if I'm reading light genre fiction. I can't pick up James Joyce the way I would have, or Trollope.
Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible.
Sort of reading it the way, for instance, I always read poetry, which is analyzing how the sentences work.
So you've kind of been robbed of the reader's basic delight.
Well, if you get bad enough genre fiction, Deal, you know, then the sentences are so terrible that you can really let it all go and just pay attention to the story. But no, I'm exaggerating a little for effect. But there is a way in which, you know, the act of writing fiction, even in the small way that I've done it, does create problems in the way that a movie actor has trouble going to a movie. Or Ron Hansen, a great Catholic writer today, once told me that, you know, he has trouble reading short stories because he's always thinking how he would have written it.
Yeah, by the way, you know, I would like our listeners to know a little more about Ron Hansen, because he is certainly someone who is Catholic and writing fiction that is regarded as among the best by most critics, secular or not. Tell us a little bit about why we should be reading Ron Hansen, because I certainly think he is someone who should be better known.
Well, you know, he is fairly well known. Several of his books have been made into movies, I think most successfully. That book with the enormously long title, what was it? The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert.
Yeah, that was made into a very good movie.
But, you know, Hitler's niece, Marietta in Ecstasy, and I think his best novel is called Atticus. And they're really wonderfully written, very Catholically infused books that are not often directly about Catholicism. When he told the story of Gerard Manley Hopkins' life...
That was a wonderful book.
You know, that was an explicitly Catholic
yes,
book.
Yes, but it was just so beautifully done.
But he sent me a note recently saying that he's going to take up Billy the Kid as the third in his trilogy of Western themes.
There's two of his novels that I'm especially fond of, and this may surprise you. His one called Hitler's Niece, which was a fascinating fictionalized account of Adolf Hitler's relationship with his niece, and his attempt at a kind of a romance called Isn't It Romantic, an Entertainment, which may not have been very well received by the critics. I thought it was wonderful.
Okay. I think Atticus is his deepest and best book.
Atticus came after the book that made his, well, at least made his reputation among Catholics, which was Mariette in Ecstasy, 1991. 5 years later came Atticus.
Right.
And his latest is entitled A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion. Have you read that?
No, not yet. I got it.
Okay.
He's a really wonderful writer, just in terms of his sentence construction,
mm-hmm.
His sense of how it is that Catholic metaphysics infuses the world with something that are symbols and yet more than symbols. And he's got, you know, a wonderful sense of that that lets him write deep Catholic books that aren't necessarily explicitly about Catholicism. He has, in other
which
words...
Which is the best kind, I think, don't you?
Yeah. No, absolutely. He has, in other words, what I've described in my recent book as a room with a view. He has a firm Catholic place to stand, which means his attention can be turned outward on mm-hmm. the world instead of back in on
he's
the church.
He's not defensive or insecure about his faith. It's part natural part of his voice, storytelling.
Right.
Do you, by the way, in the last hour, I asked you to pull out a copy of Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach. Do you have that out?
And I didn't do it because I couldn't believe that you were serious.
I'm dead serious. So while we're talking, I want you to pull that up. And while you're pulling it up, I'm going to ask you, while we're on the topic of contemporary living Catholic novelists, in the best sense. Who else do you recommend other than Ron Hanson?
I'm not sure that this anybody I would, you know, I mean, there are people I read, Michael Flynn and others, but and I like them, of course. They're great guys, but a kind of novelist, Catholic novelist who's writing deeply infused Catholic works for the ages right now, no name leaps to mind.
Well, I think that's something we need to come back to because I think, well, I can think of a few non-English writers, Torgny Lindgren, the Swedish novelist, who has not written anything for a long time, but the main body of his work, both his novels and short stories, were beautifully translated and published back in the late 80s and 90s. You know, but as you say, I mean, nothing really jumps to mind as a Catholic novelist who is someone who I sort of wait for the next book. I think there's maybe one French Catholic writer who I'll mention later who is still very active and whose book I would automatically buy when it comes out in translation. But I really can't think of anybody else in English. I think that's how would you classify Pierce Paul Reed?
Oh, I think he's a very fine writer and you know, and ranks highly among writers of his time. But if we're talking about, you know, the real A class of fiction writers, of novelists, he's not going to belong in that class, and he knows he doesn't belong in that class.
Yeah, he's turned to more historical mm-hmm. subjects. I think he wrote a piece on, was it the Spanish Civil War? I think he wrote something on the ancient order of Knights Templar, the Knights Templar.
Well, and that is, in essence, a move into genre fiction,
mm-hmm.
which I think is the right move, or at least I understand the impulse for it. I think, Deal, we have to make a distinction here between the general problem that the novel itself faces in English right at the moment and the particular form of that problem faced by Catholic novelists.
Okay, let's go down there. That sounds like an interesting... What is the problem facing the novel?
Well, again, that's the key question. And, you know, let me put it strongly and then back away from the hard application of this thesis. The strong form of it is the novel is dead. The novel is an art form.
That's pretty darn strong.
For 100 years. But let me put the strong form of the thesis, and then we can qualify it.
Okay.
For 200 years, at least, the novel was the fundamental art form of Western civilization and Anglo-American culture. We didn't have music the way the Germans did, although we had some fine composers. We didn't have the painters that the French and the Italians did, although we had some fine ones. But what English language did as its fundamental art form for over 200 years was do the novel. This was how we were going to explain ourselves to ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, we had Dickens, by the greatest novelist of all time.
And all the way down. I mean, the novel was our art form in English. Whatever its beginnings in, you know, or its parallels in ancient Roman literature, whatever its modern beginning in Cervantes, the novel as we mean it emerges in the 19th century as an essentially English thing, an English language thing. You know, Dostoevsky is reading Dickens to pieces to try to learn how to write.
Well, I mean, I'm in the middle of a new book by Michael Schmidt called The Novel, a Biography, which is the most detailed account of the origins and development of the novel that I've ever seen. And it's basically 80% English language novel.
He's a mad genius. And that book is just filled with fascinating details.
It is a fabulous book. I can't recommend it more highly.
He's insane, of course. I mean,
yeah, well, all these books are.
These things in his mind at once. So he'll, you know, there'll be a little parenthetical in which he'll say, of course, this same theme appears in these three Russian novels.
Well, it's like reading a footnote in Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics.
I know. It's just, he's wonderful. I'm in love with him his mind and the weirdness and wonder of this book. But, you know, I'm writing a little book, too, for Adam Bellow called The Death of the Novel.
This is soon to become a public thesis.
Yeah, and it's much in my mind. But if we take the novel, regardless of...
Why is it dead? I've interrupted you. Why is the novel
dead?
Yeah,
I think that, you know, the combination of authors who took their audiences seriously and audiences who took their authors seriously was a kind of unique moment, and it's pretty much gone. I propose what I called in the pages of the Weekly Standard the cocktail party test. Deal, and you would know.
Is this
that.
Like Wyndham Lewis's taxi driver test?
Kind of.
Okay.
What was the last novel that you would have been embarrassed to go to a cocktail party without having read? What was the last novel in which
I think it would have been Tom Wolfe's book about New York City. What was it called?
Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yeah. That may be, I mean, it's not really, an example of what you're talking about, but in terms of a novel that caught everyone's attention and would very likely come up at a cocktail party, I wouldn't be embarrassed to say I had read it, but I would be left out of the conversation.
No, exactly. I mean, that's the cocktail party test.
Mm-hmm.
That novel was published in 1989, and you can't name a novel since then. I can't name a novel since
no,
then.
No, I can't.
That you know the conversation at the party is going to be about.
Right. What's your answer to that question, by the way?
A Bonfire of the Vanities.
Okay.
I mean,
that's interesting.
10 years ago,
yeah.
10 years ago, I was at a gathering of conservative intellectuals in New York, you know, kind of broad-based. And this is people like Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz and, you know, Bill Buckley and Richard John Newhouse put it together. So I'm sitting there, and Richard asks the question of everybody around the table, what were the biggest changes you've noticed in your lifetime? And they all go around. I was the young guy, so I got sort of, you know, perched at the corner of the table and got to talk last. And I said, biggest change is the decline of the novel. Here you have a table full of, a round table of...
And nobody's discussing the novel.
Right. Serious New York intellectuals. And my guess is there's not a single novel in the last 5 years that all of you have read.
I think that's very, very aptly put. I read a lot of novels, as do you, and unless I get on the phone with someone like you, I'm not going to talk to anybody about them.
Right. The novel's not going to die because it's a specialized taste, but think about that. The fundamental art form of Western civilization, of Anglo-American civilization, for 200 years is now a hobby that some people have.
But in the sense of, how would you contrast that to what? A hobby in contrast to what?
In contrast to considering that these are the central constructions of the civilization, that you have to read these to know how it is that we are explaining ourselves to ourselves.
Have films taken over that role?
To some degree, but, the film, too, is in a crisis here of shared art. If nothing else, over the last 10 years, the number of movies that have been made from 1960s television programs is a sign of a certain exhaustion of the imagination.
You know, in fact, I'm thinking of your question in a larger context, and I would say the only objet d'art that I find myself having to account for are TV series like Mad Men and so forth.
Right.
I mean, I'll often go to gatherings and say, you haven't watched all of Mad Men? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. But that's, and Breaking Bad and these other programs that...
Now, Breaking Bad, too. I get the business about not having watched that.
And that's a problem for the Catholic artist. For one thing, however much a television program or movie is driven by one person, the showrunner in the case of the television series, the director, because movies were traditionally considered a director's art form, these are still shared productions, whereas the novel was supposed to be the work of a single hand. It was supposed to give us a single vision of the world. And if we don't have the novel doing that anymore, Catholic stuff becomes trickier. And now we descend from the general problem of the novel to the particular problem faced by the Catholic writer today. I think that my argument is that the novel ceased to be a public art form because of the death of metaphysics, and mostly the death of the Protestant worldview in America and England, because I think of the novel as we've been talking about, this angle.
Now, did that happen in the 20s or 30s? When did that happen?
It's been gradually happening all along. The novel ran on for a while on its own motor, but this idea that the world is thick and meaningful is necessary to do the kind of novel that we look for in the mature Dickens.
And by metaphysics, you mean a shared metaphysics.
Right, a public sense of the world as a
the world order.
Stage on which cosmically important things are happening.
Which really then ground the idea of the storytelling as a shared account of the human journey that we all have in common.
Right. This could only be explaining ourselves to ourselves if we have an ourselves, if we have a commonality of the human condition. And we don't much anymore.
And by the way, you and I both are of the generation who lived through the taking over of the academy by multiculturalism as its first wave, and then postmodernism as its second. And both of those isms are dedicated to the proposition that there is no shared human nature underlying all of our particular individual manifestations of that nature.
Right. Now, you get a burst of art out of that move, which is art that mocks those who say that there is such a thing. And that's like Piss Christ, and, you can get a burst of art out of this.
It's kind of like Tristram Shandy's of the present day.
Yeah, you know, but once that, once the frisson of shocking everyone is gone, once you've exhausted that, there's nothing left for art. The old metaphysical order is gone. The mockery of the metaphysical order and those who held it, the middle class who held it, that's been run through. And what do we have left?
And by the way, I want to remind our listeners that I'm talking with Jody Bottom, who was once editor of First Things, literary editor for the Weekly Standard, and now a well-known author and of not only fiction, nonfiction, but also fiction. Can I play devil's advocate a little bit?
Sure.
On this one? I want to say beforehand, I don't really believe the questions I'm going to ask. You take the impact of James Joyce's Ulysses, which considerable, and, of course, the fact that it was a book that was literally burned and people literally were taken away to jail for owning and so forth. Would you say that Ulysses, even though it's looked upon as one of the greatest novels ever written, was the sign of the crack-up of the metaphysics, or does it have a metaphysic itself?
See, I'm a lover of the modernist novel, and Ulysses and Ulysses in English, Remembrance of Things Past in French from Proust, these are the burst of a new wave of fiction that create the modernist novel, and I love them. But I love them because I think they were books of high ambition.
Do you think they were the last sort of breath of the novel?
I think the modernist novel, presents a unique set of problems. Where do we go from here? But the idea that somehow the great critic Philip Reeve,
sure, he wrote the Culture of Narcissism, I believe.
No, that was Kit Lash. Who wrote Culture?
Triumph of the Therapeutic.
Right, was
yeah,
Reeve.
Philip Reeve, great writer.
Reeve called Ulysses a death work, in exactly the way that you're describing. It's a dead end. He does this genius of a mind that was James Joyce, picked up the novel and shoved it into a cul-de-sac where it smashed into itself, and Ulysses was the last novel. I've never bought it. I think we have these high ambitions for the modernist novel where everything is supposed to come together. Language, human nature, the structure of the world, everything's supposed to, politics, culture, everything's going to connect. These are even higher ambitions for the novel than, the Victorians had. It goes on, and there are other great modernist works. That probably the last great modernist works are Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus, which is 1948, and Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man.
It's interesting that you would pick a novel from 1948 and a German one, because it's my belief that the last great romantic work of music was Richard Strauss's Four Last Songs, which was composed in 48, but first performed in 49.
Yeah. No, I mean, something is coming to an end there. And the next great, my view is, the next great novelistic mind to come along is Thomas Pynchon in English. And novelistic mind to write the modernist novel now, right?
Right.
And Pynchon sits down to write a great modernist novel about how everything comes together, culture and thought and language, and he ends up writing a novel about how nothing comes together and it doesn't make any sense. And this is all of his work, his early work, from The Crying of Lot, from V and The Crying of Lot 49 through Gravity's Rainbow. And, you know, this is to read him is to see a mind that's capable of putting it all together, declaring that it can no longer be all put together.
So basically, Pynchon provides you evidence for your thesis.
Exactly. Gravity's Rainbow is a book that essentially says it's all paranoia. Nothing makes any sense.
I'm almost afraid to follow this thesis. It's going to take away my love of the novel. But I see your point, at least on the surface of it, and after that book comes out, we'll definitely get on the air and talk some more about it. What's happened to poetry, Jody?
Oh, poetry died. You know, we came to the end of poetry even before we came to the end of the novel. You know, the cocktail party test. Poetry failed that, in the 1970s. Robert Lowell, whom I eulogize as the last great public poet in America, and W.H. Auden both died in the 1970s. And while there have been some very fine poets since then, and a kind of rediscovery happening of Philip Larkin, the simple fact of the matter is that we've had no poets whom you had to read.
Right. They don't pass your cocktail party test.
Right. You know, when W.H. Auden published a poem, it was an event.
Yes.
I'll give you one quick example of this. I don't know, 15 years ago, a long time ago, I published a translation of one of Ovid's anti-abortion elegies. Did you know that Ovid wrote a couple?
Yeah, I think I may have learned that from you, actually.
And so I translated one of them, loosely translated, and it turned out to be the bawdiest thing I have ever written in my life because, you know, Ovid's argument is not one that you hear often these days. It's about how wonderful the sex was with his mistress, and she should have welcomed the baby because the sex was so great. And I translated it loosely in a kind of broad and comic and bawdy way and published it, and I saw Bill Kristol, and he mentioned that he had seen the poem and thought it was funny and liked it. He started to walk away, and he turned and came back, and he said, you know, I think that's the first new poem I've read in 10 years. Now, Bill Kristol, with whom I'm really close, I don't think he's blind that I tell this story, he's the son of Irving Kristol and the great Victorian historian Gertrude Himmelfarb, who
right.
grew up in that, you know, 1950s world of New York intellectuals. If Irving and B. Kristol had said in 1958 that they didn't believe they'd read a new poem in 10 years, the Partisan Review crowd would have sent Delmore Schwartz down with a shotgun to shoot him.
We're going to come back. We're going to come back to the issue of poetry in the present in a minute after this message. I hope you'll stay with us, having a fascinating conversation with Jody Bottom.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon. The mention of places like these seem to only strike terror in our minds today. However, these are places of great biblical and spiritual richness.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
What does it take to create a truly joyful family life? It might be easier than you think. Researchers at the University of Illinois found that families who made regular time for simple things like family dinners, a game night, family days, family prayer, and even working together on household chores were much happier and more stable than families that spent their time on other activities in their community and school. In fact, the families that made time for these simple rituals were less likely to have kids with school or emotional problems, or deal with promiscuity or drug and alcohol issues, and the parents had happier marriages and greater life satisfaction to boot. If you want to experience your family life as a gift, take time unwrapping that gift by investing in those simple activities of family life that enable you to get to know one another and stay connected to one another. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
I'm back with Jody Bottom, the former editor of First Things. Jody, I asked you to get out to Dover Beach since we're talking about poetry. So I propose it's got four stanzas, so to speak. They're not of equal length. I propose that you read the first, I'll read the second, you read the third, and I'll read the fourth, and then we'll talk about it.
All right. So this is Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold, of course, the great Victorian critic who was also probably the third major poet of the Victorian age in England after Browning and Tennyson. And this is his most famous poem called Dover Beach, and it begins, "The sea is calm tonight, the tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window, sweet as the night air, only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land. Listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand. Begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in."
Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean. And it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find it also in the sound, a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea.
"The sea of faith was once, too, at the full and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long-withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges, drear and naked shingles of the world."
Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world, which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." You know, every time I read Matthew Arnold, Jody, I just don't think the word Victorian fits him. Because the word Victorian, I think, to most people, means something staid and traditional and not in the least bit agnostic or skeptic or self-examining. So why do we still use the word Victorian for Matthew Arnold?
Well, because, you know, that was his era. He actually was a Victorian. And also, I think, because there's, you know, this sadness at the loss of faith. We had talked about this in the previous hour's discussion, that Matthew Arnold puts in place here, gives its classic expression in Dover Beach, is a trope and an attitude that stays with us in this culture. And the Victorians essentially invented it. There are endless novels through the 19th century about the loss of faith and the gaining of faith. And, you know, faith is a topic for them. And Arnold takes up a more extreme view than most of them, but he's fully in the Victorian stream of talking about whether or not one has faith.
He wrote this in 1851, or at least he finished it. This was just a few years before the final, except for Russia, the final overthrow of the royal families in Europe. So you could say he wrote it in a revolutionary age. It also was the age, I believe, of Darwin. Nietzsche was on the horizon. Marx was riding away, I think, in the great library. What's it called in London? The British Museum?
British Library, yeah.
Yeah. So we forget that this age, this last half of the 19th century, was a time of tremendous self-doubt. The overthrow of century-old ruling families and the coming of literally revolution in Europe and in finally in Russia. And so it was a time when, if you put it in the larger context, Matthew Arnold certainly not only fits in, but it becomes a leading voice. But it is still odd to me that we look at writers like Tennyson and Arnold and composers like Elgar and others against the backdrop of what is seen as a very conservative and hidebound traditional symbol, which is Queen Victoria.
Well, you know, this is early days in Victorianism. I mean, we think of these people as Victorians, but in fact, John Henry Newman does the tracts for the Times and does his first great theological work before she's queen. She's only been queen for, you know, 8-9 years when Matthew Arnold is writing Dover Beach. This is early days in the Victorian reign. And yet, you know, the Newman and Matthew Arnold, who, by the way, were related.
Really?
All those Brits were related to each other. There was the Wedgwood fortune and a few other fortunes that supported these public intellectuals, and they were all third cousins of one another. They took up two opposite positions on this question of faith, but the question of faith was raised greatly and brilliantly by the 19th century. It was their question.
Now, Newman,
far more than it is for us.
Newman made his conversion public in 1845, was received into the Roman Catholic Church. And so here you have an Anglican priest moving into the Catholic Church, which he described both in terms of a philosophical move, a understanding of history, an understanding of epistemology, understanding of scripture, and so forth. He was really moving in the opposite direction of Matthew Arnold. Is that not correct?
Well, except I say yes, of course it is.
Well, yeah, yes. But I mean, I know you're going to say, but.
But, and here comes the but, and I think it's a key one. They both saw the same thing.
They saw the same problem.
Very, very early, in early days of the 19th century, you know, early days of Victoria's.
Yeah, he started his, Newman started his journey in the 30s, 1830.
Right, so before she's queen. And both of them see that Protestantism and the modern Protestant state is not going to support the Christian theological experiment. It's just not going to support it anymore. We've lost a sense of that foundation. And Matthew Arnold's response is, well, it's gone, and that makes me sad. The Sea of Faith was once like this, but now we live where ignorant armies clash by night. And John Henry Newman's response to seeing the failure of the intellectual project of Protestant Christendom is to say, I'm going to become a Catholic.
But they
each see the problem, the same problem.
Was Arnold's answer to sort of create a canon of great literature or canon of ideas? His answer was basically the humanistic answer.
Right. Art is going to take the place of it. And that's why we knew Matthew Arnold better in the 20th century as a critic and essayist than we did as a poet. It was Lionel Trilling who really insisted that we read Matthew Arnold as a poet again. But before that, through most of the 20th century, Matthew Arnold was thought of as the guy who had said, religion is dying, it makes me sad, but we have a substitute for it with art. And
we know that hasn't worked out.
Right. And Dover Beach actually predates some of that. The end, that last stanza that you read, "Ah, love, let us be true to one another," that argues that the Sea of Faith is gone, so all we have is, you know, individual love.
Yeah, we have only our own experience of loyalty, of passion, of family.
Now, eventually he's going to expand that culturally in his criticism to a claim about art. But he's got to find something, whether it's just individualism and this, you know, kind of, you know, cultivating your own garden and staying away from those big ideas, or he's going to do it culturally with art. Either way, he's addressing the problem of the retreat, the long, with melancholy, long withdrawing roar, he calls it, of the Sea of Faith pulling away from the land.
Are we seeing then the loss of a metaphysic in poetry as well as in the novel?
Oh, yeah, it's there, you know, right at that moment.
What do you do with Newman's Dream of Gerontius?
I really like the musical setting.
It makes a better musical piece set by Edward Elgar than it does really a poem.
Yeah, it's long, blank verse of a certain kind. Although, let me say, here, Deal, if you'll allow me the indulgence, there is a Catholic poet in America today named Dana Gioia.
Yeah, a good friend of both of ours.
Who has a new book out, a relatively new book out, called Pity the Beautiful, which is a collection of poems that he wrote while he and couldn't really publish or didn't publish while he was chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. And after he left at the election of Obama, he sat down for a couple years and worked on this new collection. And there's a long blank verse poem in that collection. Again, the title of the collection is Pity the Beautiful.
And the author, Dana Gioia, who, by the way, was the first guest on Church and Culture.
Ah! You know, Dana and I actually met, this is another aside, through your good offices deal, when you ran articles about rising young Catholic figures in America.
Yeah.
And Dana and I were both on that list. And got together and howled in laughter at it on the ground saying,
well,
we're
totally
if
true.
if we're qualifying for that, God help us.
I was right. I picked the winners there.
Dana's in that collection, Pity the Beautiful, there's a poem called Haunted, which is a long, you know, longish 10-page blank verse poem that is that Dana clearly intends as his masterwork and is the most Catholic poem of this kind written in America in 40 years. It's an astonishing Dana's performance from Dana.
So Dana certainly has a metaphysic, and he has strong belief in Catholic faith without any qualifications. But he's also a man who has been accepted as a master writer by the secular press, by the secular world of poets. But he's kind of a Ron Hansen version as a poet.
Right. And it's also proof that, you know, while I think your listeners would have heard Ron Hansen's name, certainly seen movies made from his books, Dana is far more famous in a public way as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts than he is as a poet.
He is, and also for his edited textbooks, for his textbooks of literature and poetry.
Because poetry as a public art form, something you had to follow if you were going to be involved in the national conversation in the public square, that died a long time ago. You don't have to know about what's going on in poetry today to be a commentator.
Is that the reason people don't read it? Is because there's no social expectation?
I think that's right. Bill Kristol, in that story I told you about Bill saying he hadn't read a new poem in 10 years, Bill Kristol is a really seriously educated guy coming from profound intellectual roots, and Bill's response was pretty much relief that it was one more thing that he didn't have to follow to be a public commentator in America. Now, you can still read all the poetry you want, of course, but that's the difference, to loop back to a distinction I made earlier, that's the difference between a public art and a hobby art.
Is there anything in the world of the arts that folks like you and me feel required to know as we meet with our friends or meet with strangers or acquaintances?
You mentioned these
TV series,
artistic TV series, and that's about it. Terry Teachout once had the line, you know, who was a great literary critic
and a film critic for Crisis.
Right, and, you know, just won the Bradley Prize for his lifetime of work and has a play off-Broadway in New York based on his biography of Louis Armstrong.
Right.
I mean, Terry is really doing wonderful work still. But Terry once said the line that if you start walking through the arts and asking yourself, you know, what were the great works of this art form in the 20th century, every single one that you name will be before 1960, most will be in between 1950, and in fact, the majority will be before 1930.
Well, is that because, I mean, I agree with that, but is that because the masterpieces have not risen to the surface yet? They haven't had time?
I don't think that that's quite the case. I mean, if we think of the great composers, how many of them were discovered late? I mean, Mozart was famous in his lifetime. These novelists that we're talking about, you know, down to Saul Bellow, they were famous in their lifetimes. You know, the number of figures who are like Emily Dickinson or Gerard Manley Hopkins discovered only after their deaths by a more mature understanding of art, they're very, very few and far
between. I can think of great composers who certain works were rejected in their lifetime only to become famous later on. I think the only composers I know of who had to wait to be known is because their works were essentially unpublished, or they were destroyed by the Nazis or something of that,
right.
that nature.
You know, but it's not, it's for all that we see this as a kind of pattern. Mark Twain has a story about Millet and a bunch of French painters who draw straws so that one of them can pretend to have died. only painters who are dead in France are declared masters. and they're all so broke that they decide one of them will die and the rest of them will go around saying, oh, the master is dead. And, you know, but for all that we have that pattern in our mind, in fact, most of the great artists of the 20th century that we're talking about, or before that, were really quite famous in their own life.
Well, let me ask you this question then. I'm talking with Jody Bottom, who is, among other things, former editor of First Things. Is there any segment of the arts where masterpieces are being produced, where there's actually a real significant development of the art form?
I don't know. You had a music critic writing for you for a while.
Robert Riley.
Bob Riley. And he always insisted that there was stuff going on in classical music against which, you know, audiences have turned now completely. There was a time as late as the 1970s and 1980s in which, you know, every city in America had a classical music station. Or two, and they were in competition with each other, and that's really declined. But he insisted that, you know, unbeknownst to anyone, or to very many people, to mass audiences, really serious and interesting work was going on in classical music, especially in Poland.
Well, I think there are four or five truly great composers who, if they're not alive right now, you know, composed over the last 20 or 30 years, Morten Lauridsen would be one.
Huh. Okay.
Who wrote the incredible setting of Aquinas' poem, O Magnu Mysterium, which is truly a masterpiece.
You know, there are directors, movie directors, who are very good, and yet the magisterial ones that we think of, you know, were doing their work in the 70s. You know, the ones who are still alive. I'm thinking of Francis Ford Coppola, for instance. You know, this is now thinking of movie directors as auteurs, of creators solely responsible for a great piece of art. The painting, I just have ceased. I, too, you know, here's the cocktail party test. There's not a sculptor or a painter who I feel I have to follow in order to pay any attention or in order to go to a cocktail party, in order to participate in public life.
I think the one film director that I would go to his film regardless is Terrence Malick.
Okay.
I think of his Tree of Life as a true modern masterpiece. I don't know if you've seen it.
No.
Malick, by the way, wrote his dissertation in Paris on Heidegger. And then he became a filmmaker.
But I think we'd also, you know, in painting, I don't know. Now I have friends like Greg Wolfe, a really fine critic, who edits a magazine of the art
Image.
That takes religion seriously called mm-hmm. Image, that everyone should subscribe to who's interested in these kinds of topics. And Greg has always been a rah-rah guy. He thinks that there's great Catholic and great Catholic and non-Catholic art that takes religion seriously going on right now. But my view is that great art happens in particular forms, and that there has to be an agreement between the audience and the author about that form before it happens. Shakespeare can't invent the play.
So the novel takes a village.
Right. To establish the form, and then the genius emerges in it.
You know, it's very true, though, when you look at the history of developments or in any tradition, whether it's painting or music or the novel, they do seem to come in clusters. You'll have a lot of great works written in a generation and in a certain place, like Paris during the days of Debussy and Ravel, or London in the days of Elgar, then Vaughan Williams, and Gerald Finzi, and Frederick Delius. Two common clusters.
Okay.
Is that what you're saying? That there's a certain moment where culture comes together, in not so much worldwide, but in a certain place, certain city or certain nation.
Turn into a discussion of what are called golden ages. And I think actually we have undergone in English what will later be seen as a golden age of children's literature in the last 20 years, which is a little unfortunate.
Fascinating thought. We have to explore that in another.
But it means that adults are reading children's fiction.
By the way, some people think we're in a golden age of television with these landmark TV series like Mad Men and Breaking Bad and so forth.
In the 20th century, we saw something like a golden age of English poetry with the burst of modernism,
with Auden and so forth,
Pound and P.S. Eliot. Polish poetry went through a golden age later.
Now we're getting really obscure, Jody. We got come back. I think you know, and of course we have the great Polish films of Kiyakowski, who. By the way, speaking of a Catholic artist, Kiyakowski is considered, along with Robert Bresson and a few others, as the greatest of all Catholic filmmakers.
So, you know, I would look to Alfred Hitchcock, but still.
I love Alfred Hitchcock.
I know what you mean. So it's possible, and sometimes it is physical location, although I think the ease of getting books and the internet has changed that formula to some degree.
Hugely.
You know, Shakespeare.
I mean, we're just overwhelmed with content now. Content
right.
is just, it's almost to the point where you feel stifled to read, listen, anything, because there's just so much at your fingertips.
So, you know, that's changed the dynamic of the geographical location that you were talking about. But still, I think, you know, we can have these golden ages again, but the forms themselves have to be in place for these kinds of geniuses to emerge. And in fact, my description of a golden age is that it's not measured by its true geniuses. Because genius comes when it will. You know, the Holy Spirit guides that. What a golden age does is elevates the second tier so that they do much better work in a golden age than they would otherwise. William Carlos Williams and Wallace Stevens are second-tier poets who are elevated into the first tier because they live in a golden age of modernist poetry.
Oh, that's very well put. You could certainly look at the impact of Hemingway on Fitzgerald and so forth. But we've come to the end of our time. Thank you, Jody Bottom, for being a guest on Church and Culture. But before we go, I want to mention your recent book entitled An Anxious Age, the post-Protestant ethic and the spirit of America. I urge listeners to read that book and join us again when we come back to discuss it. Thank you, Jody.
Thank you for having me, Dale.
And please come back and join me again on Church and Culture at this time and on this day next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
As Christians, we are taught that what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart. And in Ephesians, it reads, "No bad word should come from your mouth, but only what is good and edifying, that it may give grace to those who hear." If you want to have a clean mouth without having to use soap, start by cleansing the heart. Think back to those various points in life when the anger that festered inside eventually percolated up and right out of your mouth with words of hate for people who have hurt you, offended you, lied to you, used you, abused you, stole from you, or perhaps altered your life forever. When we hold on to the past, we cloud the love of Jesus Christ, and what emerges is the pain inflicted on us from mankind. If you find yourself cursing, spewing hateful words about others, or often negative about life, then close your mouth and open your heart. Fill it with the love of our Lord, and let His words emerge from your mouth. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the communication evangelist.
Manresa Jesuit Retreat House in Bloomfield Hills begins its fifth annual series of Sunday afternoon concerts. Join us on Sunday, October 5th at 3 p.m. for Autumn Leaves, a recital by mezzo-soprano Dorothy Dwensing, bass baritone Carl Glendening, and pianist Joe Ballesteri. Join the musicians following concert for hors d'oeuvres, beverages, and conversation. Tickets are $18 in advance or $20 at the door. For further information or to order tickets, phone 248-644-4933.
The Ave Maria Radio app is available for all Apple and Android users. Listen to Ave Maria Radio live or listen to your favorite shows whenever you want, on demand. Like what you heard? Post a link on your email, Facebook, or Twitter account in just two taps. You can even leave a voice message on our feedback page. Purchase books or look up references from our hosts and guests, and it's all absolutely free. Just go to the App Store and type Ave. It's just that simple. The Ave Maria Radio app.
This is Life News Radio. I'm Jim Anderson. The second ruling by Circuit Court Judge Lee Yackel against a Texas law that would admittedly close abortion clinics has been overturned on appeal. Not only does this appeals court ruling allow the Texas law to go into effect, it certainly adds drama to November elections in Texas. Gubernatorial candidate and Attorney General Greg Abbott filed the appeal last month to uphold that law, and his opponent, Texas State Senator Wendy Davis, led filibusters and protests against the law, which would close abortion clinics unable to meet new abortion safety standards. Abortionist Ulrich Klopfer is no longer able to do abortions because he failed to submit to Indiana safety standards for surgical clinics outside hospitals. He also faces separate hearings in December and January because in two separate occasions, Klopfer failed to properly report suspected or actual statutory rape. This is Life News Radio.